Next case for argument is 21-1817, Bonner v. McDonough. Mr. Bonner, don't get too comfortable. We're ready for you whenever you are.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Public policy, law, and considerations of moral duty support providing dependency and indemnity compensation to the families of service members who are fatally injured in the line of duty. A serviceman or service person can follow a call to military service that is frequently very dangerous with a clear conscience that if the cost of his service is his life, his spouse and children will be taken care of by laws administered by the Veterans Administration. The life, career, and service of the veteran in this case, Emmett Bonner, whose 37 years of service in the Navy, including combat in World War II, Korea and Vietnam, is a credit to the greatest generation. He died in 1975 at age 57, 3 years after his retirement, of a covered herbicide disease and of exposure to ionizing radiation at an H-bomb detonation in Uetok. The Veterans Court below stated, quote, the veteran almost certainly died from NHL. That's at Appendix 5, Line 9. The protection Congress has provided for veterans and their families was erroneously denied to Emmett Bonner's widow by the VA for 20 years. A divided panel...
Our time is limited. I appreciate and respect everything that you've said so far, but we're still constrained by our case law and the law in this area. So let me go directly to that, which is... If we're talking about a CUE, clear and unmistakable error, it's kind of an uphill battle for everyone because the standard requires the record based, the error be based on the record and the law that existed at the time. And yes. I think the time here was 1976. So even the evidence, I guess I'm not clear on what your argument is as to why even the possible misdiagnosis here seems to be based on a report in 1995. That report didn't exist in 1976. So even if we accept that report, how can we say that the RO made a clear and unmistakable error in 1976? Well, you're familiar with the CUE law, and that's what we're bound by.
Well, yes, Your Honor, we also have raised the issue that the claim is still open due to a constitutional error of lack of notice.
I understand that. So if you were not to prevail on that lack of notice issue, then you agree that under CUE law you would not have a viable claim here.
No, I don't agree to that at all, Your Honor. The facts that were found at the RO in 1976, were found by violating a statute or rule 3.312, which is a procedural rule that requires the Veterans Administration to find cause of death, exercising sound judgment, looking at all the facts, and considering especially autopsy reports. And if the court looks, I believe it's page 35 of the appendix, 36, it's the... rating decision that was made then clearly violates 3.312. There's no showing at all that the entire file was looked at. There's no mention at all, for example, of the exposure to ionizing radiation. There's no discussion in the
Were those, just for my own clarification, I really don't know the answer to this, were those regulations in effect in 1970?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's one of the points we'd actually like this court to address. Yes, 1961. 1961 is as far back as I could trace 3.312. That regulation requires, it says that the cause of death shall be determined by exercise of sound judgment. So it's a procedural mandate on the Veterans Administration to exercise sound judgment without recourse to speculation, considering all the facts of the case, particularly autopsy reports. None of that was done.
So what was it in the record that that existed that you're saying that the VA did not consult and consider in 1976, that would have made it undebatably clear that veteran died from non-Hodgkin's.
I would say it's the National Naval Medical Center's autopsy report has in it, if you take a look, please, to page 21 of the government's brief, petitioner or appellant's brief, page 21. I've listed there
Is there something in the JA?
It's in appendix 32 to 33.
Okay.
Is where it is, but it's also, the document itself, the National Naval Medical Center's autopsy protocol, is at appendix 32 to 33. The excerpted pieces from it that I listed with bullet points are on page 21 of our brief. It is uncontroverted in the record that all of these facts exist. Our point is that 3.312, as of 1961, requires sound judgment, considering especially autopsy reports. Now, what happened there is it's appendix 30.
I'm not quite clear what your point is. If they had looked at, you're clear they didn't look at the autopsy report, and if they were to have looked at this report, it's indisputably clear that they would have reached the diagnosis that was offered in 1990.
They would have found persuasive evidence exists that non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was suffered by the veteran. Indeed, the Veterans Court below has found that it's almost certain.
I mean, at A26, it talks about most likely possibility being Hodgkin's disease, right?
Yes, but the problem.
So where in this same report does it really make clear and decisive that what they meant when they said most likely Hodgkin's disease wasn't really what they meant? What they really meant to say was non-Hodgkin's disease.
The problem, if I may, with that analysis is that it's that binary either-or analysis that does not take into account the first line of 3.312, which is that contributory causes of death also are sufficient for a service connection. So whether or not he had Hodgkin's disease, that's fine. As we pointed out in the court below and every chance we've gotten, that it's not an either-or inquiry.
Just to be really simple-minded, you can have both?
Absolutely. It's called composite lymphoma. I have documents for the National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Health, that I cited previously.
So what in this autopsy report are you saying indisputably establishes?
Okay. The fact that the majority of the cells are bizarre cells, not totally characteristic of Reed-Sternberg cells.
I'm sorry. Are you reading from 832?
I'm reading from page 21 of our brief that I could get appendix 32 and find it in there.
Appendix 32? What page of your brief then?
It's on page 21 of our opening brief, which I have excerpted this. There is an entire litany here of reasons that the diagnosis of Hodgkin's disease is basically self-impeaching. The lymphoma is either going to be Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's. There is a ton of evidence here that it was non-Hodgkin's. Non-Hodgkin's can be considered as a contributory cause of death. None of the items here on page 23 have been controverted by the government, and our appeal is that the VA was required to particularly consider autopsy reports and didn't do it at all. If you look at page, if you please, I need my glasses now, page 34 of the record. There is the autopsy the rating decision. The rating decision makes no mention at all of the autopsy protocol, period, despite being mandated to do so. So what we're saying is that the facts that the VA used were procedurally, they didn't follow the right procedure to do it, and if they had, they would have seen all of these reasons, which I can enumerate.
Let me move you on, because time is limited, to kind of the second piece of your argument, which is the failure of notice. lack of notice. If we agree with the Veterans Court that the universe of documents that were sufficient to provide notice were the 21-523, the RO decision from 1976, the notice of appellate rights,
absolutely.
What is missing in these documents?
What's missing is the rating decision, which is on page 34 of the appendix. That rating decision was never served on the widow. The first time the widow became aware of it was in 1995. So this was we raised this with the Veterans Court and with the government. The government has never provided any proof at all, or even any contradiction that this document was not served on the widow.
The VA form at 836 indicates that the rating occurred on February 9th, 1976.
Right? Yeah, that's the top right-hand corner here.
Right. So it does provide a date.
Sure, they rated it and they stuck it in their file. They sure didn't give it to us.
But I guess what we're trying to figure out isn't that enough for at least that component of what we've held is a required element for sufficient notice of
the
denial of a claim.
The notice has to be delivered to the widow. The widow has never saw this document.
Right, and well, I don't recall anything from our case law that demands that the actual rating form be submitted to the claimant.
I think I see your point. If with respect
just
to
the date of the decision has to be communicated, as well as the fact that the claim had been denied and the basis for the denial, as well as appeal rights.
The only evidence of that, which respectfully, take a look, please, at appendix page 36. It would be useful to see that.
Right. This is the VA form.
That's the VA form disallowing. That would be the only place from which the widow would have known that there was a rating decision at all. And the only place that appears on that form is the top right-hand corner. If you take a look at the form there, the top right-hand corner in box number 10, remarks. Now recall, this is being sent to a service widow, and they sent her this form. If you look at that box, now maybe seasoned jurists of veterans law would be able to decipher what looks like RALTI 2-9.76, right? That's hardly notice that there was a rating decision on February 9th, 1976, nor what the content of it is. So it's insufficient notice, Your Honor. The widow would have no idea looking at the remarks column and seeing that.
But she knows she's got notice of what the decision is.
She gets is this thing saying disallowance, disability or death claim with a check box. Right? So maybe she can maybe get from that the idea that, well, it's been disallowed. The problem with that is it's misleading. And here's why. There's a presumption of regularity that applies to the Veterans Administration, that people either sort of generically at least used to believe, or the VA knows that it enjoys this presumption of regularity. When the widow gets this thing, assuming that she can figure out that this is a denial, it doesn't say dependency and indemnity compensation anywhere on this at all. The only place, even something
she had only one claim pending, right?
That's it.
But it was denied, so this is not...
Well,
like
a disability, there was a pension claim floating around at the same time, too.
Well, right on top, the name of the form it's a disallowance form.
Yeah, disallowance, I'm sure. But she gets a disallowance, something got disallowed, disability death claim, maybe it's the DIC. She looks at it and says, okay, I guess my claim, whichever ones I have out there, has been denied.
Yeah.
Right? Now she has to decide whether or not to appeal it. Mm-hmm. Right? And with respect to that, that's where our notice issue is. If you're a service widow, the government has a presumption of regularity. They must have looked at this very carefully. They must have looked at his entire service record. No. Appendix 34, the rating decision, shows that didn't happen. They must considered our claim the way we filed it. Her claim, in black and white there on page 35 of the appendix.
But the issue, we're not relitigating the sufficiency of, or the correctness of that in this context. No. We're just your claim is that she didn't have notice, and therefore the claim is still open.
Right.
So arguments with respect to whether this was informative enough and yada yada, I mean, that's the basis for her to have appealed it, not the argument, not basis for you to say she didn't have enough notice.
She doesn't know whether to appeal unless she's given, this court in Royal versus Wilkie dealt with that. Sufficient notice to be constitutionally sufficient has to provide the party, you know, being ruled against with sufficient notice to understand the reasons for the denial, right, and not be misleading. It's misleading in that the widow was not told that her claim was being considered only for Hodgkin's disease. She wrote down cancer. So when she gets a denial, she understands that her cancer claim has been denied. Later on, the VA says, no, we didn't read it as a cancer claim. We just read it as a Hodgkin's disease claim. Therefore, we're denying your claim, right? So that's what happened in this case. Number two is she thinks, well, he must have looked at the done a really good job of obeying 3.312 or whatever the requirement of due diligence. And there was no due diligence at all. Taking a look at if you were, let me ask you, this. If you take a look at page 34. This is supposed to be, this is the rating decision that's enforced right now, upon which benefits 20 years worth of DIC, it's almost $600,000, are being denied. And there's hardly due diligence showed here or compliance with 3.312. So sending this disallowance disability or death claim to the widow.
Can I ask about the one of the alternative arguments that I think the Veterans Court articulated on the, not the CUE claim, but the notice, which, let's put this under the heading of subsumed.
Yes.
So why is it wrong to say that the 1995 RO and 2001 board decisions did in fact answer the question that you say was still outstanding, which is the question, did Admiral Bonner have non-Hodgkin's when he died?
Right. With respect to subsuming it, I do have.
The theory is, if they did answer it, then even if an answer to that question wasn't final in 76, it's been final for 20 years.
That's a Brown versus West, and I have something on that right here. As an assignment of error with respect to the Veterans Court's decision, on appendix page 10, the Veterans Court opines that the doctrine of delayed subsuming applies to the widow's post-Federal Circuit Q motion. So after we were here last time, told file a Q motion, we filed it. The Veterans Court did not develop why it cited to this doctrine. It did not even use the word delayed subsuming, but merely footnoted the CFR citation applicable to the VA in this court's 2000 Brown versus West decision. The Veterans Court ruled that this delayed assuming was to the effect the 1976 RO decision, unappealed, was thereafter subsumed in the 2001 board decision. This court in Brown, which is 203 Fed 3rd at 1381, stated, in addition, a board decision that considers a collateral attack on a final unappealed RO determination can subsume the unappealed RO determination under certain circumstances. I'll get to the certain circumstances momentarily. This court continued in Brown, in a case in which the board's decision subsumes an unappealed RO determination on collateral attack, the veteran may not challenge the original RO determination as containing clear and unmistakable error, but must proceed before the board and urge that there was clear and unmistakable error in the board decision that subsumed the unappealed RO determination. As to proceeding in Q before the board, we did that. We filed and directed our Q motion with the board. It's on Appendix 97. Appendix 97 is our Q motion.
I'm sorry, I just want to interrupt. So I want to put Q completely to one side for now, because you have two paths along which you're trying to get relief. One is you did have a Q claim. I mean, you had a meritorious Q claim.
Yes.
But wholly apart from that, you have this separate path in which you say there's still a live issue. There has been no final adjudication. There wasn't one. There still hasn't been one. Therefore, we can actually judge the answer
yes.
to the NHL question without this extremely demanding standard of Q, the way we would have done on an original appeal.
Right.
That's the piece that I'm trying to understand. Why is it not the case that even if notice was inadequate in February of 1976, that the question of whether Admiral Bonner had NHL was answered in 95 and 2001. So that question has been finally answered for 20 years.
Well, my answer to that would be it didn't survive this court's opinion last time we were here. George Archer's opinion was that at the behest of the government, by the way, so the court didn't make this up on its own. It was urged to do this by the government so that the appellants can't collaterally attack this decision. It must use, it is to file a Q petition. So the court ruled that we should do that. So the court was either sending us on a fool's errand, which I don't believe the court was doing, and did so at the instance of the government. So the reason we're here, and this whole case has been laundered through this court, sent back out by this court at the government's request to file a Q motion, which we've done. With respect to the absolutes, assuming though, between the 1975 claim and the 2001 board decision, that was the board decision that we appealed to this court. And this court said, file a Q motion about it. So that's what we did, and we filed a Q motion on page 97 of the record with the Department of Veterans Affairs, Board of Veterans Appeals of Washington, D.C., and filed a Q motion with them and concurrently with the Department of Veterans Affairs Regional Office. Not only that, but the Department of Veterans Affairs Regional, the Board, and I'll pass this up if I may, but or not, the Board, after we filed our Q motion with the Board, which is what the subsuming cases say you should do, and it's what we did do, the Board said they don't have any jurisdiction on this or any other matter, and they're referring it to the Board. I gave a copy of it's not in the appendix. It's in page 170 of the record on appeal, and it's referred to in our brief. I had given a copy to opposing counsel. May I pass up just one copy of the record 170? Or not, if it would be useful to you.
It's
germane.
Is it in? So it's not in the appendix?
It's not in the appendix, but it is in the record of appeal. And I don't need it. I allege in the brief that the board sent it back down.
I think that's sufficient.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're way ahead. We're way beyond your time. We'll restore some of that. Let him hear from you.
Thank you. For the reasons that okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have an Occam's razor argument coming up for you on rebuttal.
Mr. Bonner, it's easy to forget, but put your mask back on.
Oh, sir.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Although Mr. Bonner raises a number of different legal arguments, a variety of arguments, he cannot prevail in this case unless he can convince this court that Admiral Bonner died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1975. That cause of death issue is the foundation upon all other legal arguments.
Just to be clear, do you agree that it would be sufficient if it were the case that non-Hodgkin's was a contributory cause, even if the Admiral also had Hodgkin's?
So,
on this threshold question, do you agree that these are not either or, you can actually have both?
I'm not sure I can respond to that, Judge Taranto, and here is why. Number one, that would be the type of factual question that would be outside this court's jurisdiction on appeal in either event. More importantly than that, what we are talking about here is a challenge to a resolution of a Q motion. And in a Q motion...
No, we're talking about two things. right? That we have a Q motion and a there has never been a final determination.
So we don't think that the final determination part can survive without Mr. Bonner also showing that Admiral Bonner died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We think they are connected to each other. But if I can just respond to the prior question. Because this is a Q motion, what we have to do is we have to look to the evidence that existed at the time of the original decision. And in 1976, when the regional office first disallowed the claim, what the VA had is an autopsy report and a death certificate, both of which definitively noted that Hodgkin's disease was the cause of death, and neither one of which noted.
Well, be really careful about the language. I definitively noted that it was the, I think that goes a little bit far. Page 26 of the appendix has slightly softer language, doesn't it? And then the gist of his claim about the autopsy report is that when you carefully look at, what is it, page 33, I guess, of the appendix, there are warning flags there that something else might have been going on.
That's true. The medical evidence here was not entirely definitive one way or another. But the examiner who prepared the autopsy report looked at that entirety of evidence and concluded that the cause of death was Hodgkin's disease. And I'm looking at page 24 of the joint appendix, where the cause of death is listed. There is a list there, and that is the first thing that's listed. And it says cause of death, colon, Hodgkin's disease. That is a definitive determination that that is the cause of death. And the...
And sorry, is there some greater certainty that we can take from that than is reflected in the sentence on page 26 at the end of the second full paragraph? The most likely, it was felt that the most likely possibility was Hodgkin's disease. Well, most likely.
And as I said, there were some contradictory evidence, certainly. But this language, I would submit, is no more uncertain than the language in the NIH report in 1995, which also talked about some contradictory medical evidence, some evidence suggesting Hodgkin's disease and some evidence suggesting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and concluded that the NIH at the time favored non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as opposed to Hodgkin's disease.
You kind of said early that when I asked you, is this a either-or thing, can somebody have both, that you can't really answer it. I forget whether you said you can't answer it or we can't answer it. What, if anything, in this document might, and some of which is medical records, and some of which is commentary on medical records, might give an answer one way or the other to the question, do doctors understand that you can have both of these lymph cancer problems?
So I can't quite tell you, Judge Toronto, whether doctors understand that or not, or whether they understood it or not in 1976. But what I can tell you is, number one, the court cannot answer that because it's a fact question. Number two, if we look at the autopsy report, which after weighing the evidence, the medical evidence at the time, we believe definitively concluded that the cause of death was Hodgkin's disease. That was the conclusion. And then you look at the death certificate, which also listed Hodgkin's disease and only Hodgkin's disease as the cause of death. It's important to remember that neither one of those documents either listed a contributory cause of death or listed a second possible cause of death that may be a primary cause of death. They both listed Hodgkin's disease as the only cause of death. They didn't discuss any other types of cancer. They didn't mention non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is the issue here. The evidence in 1976, we believe, was definitive. Despite this medical uncertainty, they took the evidence, they weighed that evidence, and concluded that Hodgkin's disease was the result. And that is the only evidence that certainly this court can go on in a Q motion, but it's also the only evidence that the regional office at the time in 1976 had to go by. And looking at this autopsy report and looking at the death certificate.
Do I remember right that NIH in 1995 had some additional lab information that, no?
I'm not sure if they had additional information. Okay. What they did have, though, is 20 more years of medical knowledge.
Oh, okay.
That's correct. And the NIH report specifically said that their task was to review this claim with current medical understanding. And I'm paraphrasing here. That's not verbatim what they said. But that 20-year difference may have made a difference in terms of what the medical understanding was as to what the differences are between Hodgkin's disease and Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Well, I guess I'm thinking, so did the regional office in 1976 not only have the autopsy report, but the 42 slides that the NIH refers to in 1995?
I believe that's correct.
That they had both?
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
Yes. So going back to the cause of death issue, again, we think that that is really the foundation on which all other legal arguments rest, including the finality argument, to which I'll get in a minute. And there are four separate reasons why this court cannot be convinced that Admiral Bonner died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1975. The first one is because that is a factual determination that requires the court to review the medical record and make determinations based on that medical record. And that is well outside this court's limited appellate jurisdiction under 38 U.S.C. section 7292. Number two, and I've already discussed this, but in a Q motion, we have to look back to the evidence that existed at the time of the original decision.
I'm sorry, can you just explain to me again why, in order to decide whether the non-Q argument in front of us, the finality, that is the lack of finality argument, why, in order for us to rule on that, we need to be persuaded that the Admiral died of Hodgkin's?
Sure.
As opposed to saying, goodness, there hasn't been a final adjudication. The Veterans Court and the Board need to look at that question without the Q lens. And they haven't done it, and the Veterans Court seems to say at one point, it's almost certain that he died of NHL, not Hodgkin's.
They did say that. They said that outside of the context of Q, Your Honor.
Well, why is the finality question that we have in front of us, not the Q obviously is affected by the,
right.
by the factual question. Why is the finality question affected?
Because Mrs. Bonner was granted DAC benefits for Hodgkin's disease in 1995. And the RO and the board and the Veterans Court and this court and Bonner v. Nicholson determined that the scope of the claim that was filed in 1975 only included Hodgkin's disease, did not include non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So if we have a non-final decision, which I don't believe we do, and I'll discuss that in a minute, but if the court concludes that there is a non-final decision, there is a non-final decision as to Hodgkin's disease. And that is all that exists unless and until Mr. Bonner is able to prove that Admiral Bonner died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Now, even if the court looks to it as a direct appeal, right, if it's non-final, it would be a direct appeal as opposed to an appeal of a Q motion. The cause of death issue still suffers from some of the same problems that it does in a Q challenge. It still has the problem that it's a factual determination. It still has the issue that the NIH report does not clearly establish that non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is the correct cause of death as opposed to Hodgkin's disease. And finally, there is the issue preclusion issue. We have to remember that Mrs. Bonner already filed a claim based on the NIH report. She submitted the NIH report to the VA, and she told the VA, based on that NIH report, that Admiral Bonner died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That was reviewed by the RO in 1995, and the RO made a determination that that is incorrect. And that was affirmed by the board, it was affirmed by the Veterans Court, and it was affirmed by this court in Bonner v. Nicholson.
Could you have a JA site for the 1995 RO decision that there was no non-Hodgkin's cause at issue here?
Sure. So That RO decision, and I'm sorry I misspoke, it's 1997. It took a few years.
There was a claim in 1995, and it took a while.
Exactly.
Things took quite a long time here.
Yeah. Right. So that that supplemental statement of the case begins on Appendix 56. But specifically, I'll refer you, Your Honor, to page 60 of the joint appendix, which is part of that statement of the case. And when you get there, I'll read from that, if I may. There is a paragraph towards the bottom that begins with general counsel precedent. The second sentence of that paragraph reads, "Report from National Institutes of Health, dated June 19, 1995, was submitted in support of the claimant's allegations that the cause of the veteran's death was misdiagnosed as Hodgkin's disease and contends that the cause was due to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma." Then there's a short discussion of that, and then the conclusion, and I'll start from the second to last sentence of that same paragraph. It reads, "The report is negative for evidence confirming that the disease was ever reclassified to provide for a definitive diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's disease. Therefore, General Counsel Precedent Opinion 5-94, dated February 18, 1994, is not for application." And we have confirmation of this decision in the Veterans Court and in this court. And I can read you those portions as well, Your Honor. So if we look to the Bonner v. Nicholson decision before the Veterans Court, this is not in the joint appendix, but I'm looking at Bonner v. Nicholson, 19 Veterans Appeals, beginning at page 188. On page 195 of that opinion, the very end of page 195, spilling into page 196, after having some initial discussion of the NIH report, the Veterans Court concluded, and I quote, "A review of the record in its entirety reveals that the board had a plausible basis to find that the cause of Mr. Bonner's death was Hodgkin's disease." So this is an affirmance of the decision that the cause of death was Hodgkin's disease. And then this court, in footnote 1, so the citation is 497 Federal 3rd Reporter 1323. Footnote 1, there is a short discussion of the NIH report. I'll read it to you. The footnote begins, "Contrary to the dissent's assertion, the 1995 NIH report re-examining Admiral Bonner's condition at the time of his death was ambiguous, in that his illness simulated Hodgkin's disease, but also favored a diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This does not demonstrate that the 1975 diagnosis of Hodgkin's disease as the cause of death was indisputably incorrect." So that indicates that there is a preclusive effect based on these prior decisions that already looked at the very argument that Mr. Bonner is raising here. The issue that Mr. Bonner is raising is, does the NIH report demonstrate that Admiral Bonner's cause of death was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? And the answer to that, as the Veterans Court and this court already held in the prior round, is a resounding no, because, at the very least, that evidence was inconclusive. Now, I do want to note finality for a moment as well. We don't think that issue would resolve the case against us without the cause of death also being resolved against us. But this case is in no way like Ruel v. Wilkie, because in Ruel, there was a single sentence in an unrelated claim that did not identify the DAC claim at all, and all it said is the veteran did not die, and again, I'm paraphrasing, the veteran did not die from a service-connected condition. That's not what we have here. What we have here, and I think Mr. Bonner would agree with me, we have a disallowance form and a letter, both of which went to Mrs. Bonner in 1976. And I'll take a moment so I can refer the court to the right citation. So the disallowance form appears on page 36 of the joint appendix.
And the letter is the next page, right?
So page 36 of the joint appendix.
I'm sorry, is the letter the next page?
Well, part of the letter is the next page. The next page is page 1 of the letter, but a full version of the letter appears on pages 129 to 130 of the joint appendix. It's important to include the second page because that second page contains notice of appeal rights. But if I may go through that form for a moment, Your Honor, that form in box 20 towards the bottom where it says disallowance worksheet, specifically, and I'm back on page 36 of the joint appendix, just so it's clear. So box 20, there's a check mark where it says disallowance of DIC and request for evidence. So the form identifies this specific claim being disallowed. Then at the top, box 13, reasons for disallowance, there's a check mark next to box 06, which reads, death not due to service. There is a reason why the claim was disallowed. And in box 10, remarks, it says rating 2976. So there is an identification of the date on which the claim was disallowed. And then if we look to the letter, and I'll refer the court to page 129 of the joint appendix instead of page 30, just because of that second page. So this is the letter dated March 8, 1976, and it reads, we regret that we are unable to pay your claim for dependency and indemnity compensation, and I'll stop there for a moment, again, an identification of the specific claim being disallowed, because our evidence does not establish that the veteran's death was due to a disease or injury incurred in or aggravated by military service. Again, there is a specific identification of the reason why the claim is disallowed. And then on the next page, Appendix 130, there is a Notice of Procedural and Appeal Rights, which is specific to the DAC claim that was disallowed. Those things did not exist in Ruel, and that case is therefore distinguishable from this one. And there's also the subsuming doctrine that Judge Taranto, you asked about. Separate and apart from all of this, in 1995, again, the court looked at a specific request about changing the effective date of that DAC claim. It looked at the NIH report. It decided that because the cause of death issue cannot be resolved in favor of Mrs. Bonner, as well as some other issues, she cannot obtain an earlier effective date, the same earlier effective date that she seeks today. So at the very least, this 1976 decision was subsumed by the 1997 RO decision, which was later affirmed by the board, by the Veterans Court, and by this court.
I think your time has expired. Anything you have to tell us that's really essential?
I don't think so. If there's no further questions, I want to thank the court for its time, and again, thank that the court either dismiss the case or affirm the Veterans Court's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bonner, I think you exhausted your time, but we'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal if you need it.
Okay. With respect to the court to consider that the Appendix 36, that disallowance claim, the disallowance worksheet, if you look in the middle of that form, the government's trying to rely on a checkbox which a service would have no idea what it is. And furthermore, it's in an area that looks like it's a record-keeping part for the VA administrative purposes. Should have no idea what RALTI 2-9.76 means either. So to say that this constitutes sufficient notice is basically to license the VA to cite this court's opinion that this kind of notice, this totally useless notice, I should have no idea that what they did. They should have told her that we are considering your claim for cancer only as Hodgkin's disease, not non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I'm sorry. And that we didn't follow 3.312, which requires sound judgment considering all of the evidence, including autopsy reports. So in 1 minute, I think I can do this. We have raised the collateral estoppel issue in this case, and the failure to apply applicable law 3.312. We raised a due process violation, which is a claim is still open. Nobody, she wouldn't know to file an appeal. She said, well, the government's right. I guess they denied my claim. I have no idea that they've manhandled and denied us the procedure that we were due on this claim. Okay, so my Occam's razor argument, here it is, and I'll sit down. And it's all resolved. If this court finds that the 1975 claim is still open because of notice error and it's misleading, and that's Ruel versus Wilkie. I think it does apply. If you read Ruel, it's right on point with this case. If you find it was still open, then it was, quote, pending before the VA on May 3rd, 1989. This is an argument that I have. It's the 38 CFR 3.816. It comprises the last pages of our opening brief and also our reply brief. I parse it out. But here it is. So if you do find that one fact, then the rest of the facts are not controverted. I don't believe. The effective date of the claim is the date the claim was received by the VA. That's September the 9th, 1975, Appendix 35. That date's not disputed. The VA shall pay such unpaid retroactive benefits to the class member's estate. It's undisputed that the appellant is the executor of the widow's estate. That's Appendix 48. Class member means a surviving spouse of a deceased veteran who died from a covered herbicide disease. It's not disputed that Admiral Bonner was a Vietnam veteran, nor he is deceased, nor that the widow was his surviving spouse. But two more pieces to it. Covered herbicide disease means a disease provided in 3.309A. And lastly, if a veteran was exposed to a herbicide agent during active naval service, the call record shows two tours of duty in Vietnam, including an entire year ashore in Da Nang up by the DMZ. Right? The following diseases shall be service-connected. Hodgkin's disease and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Both are covered diseases. So if the court does find that the case is still open, the court should do what the court did in Ruel and order the secretary to pay benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.